My name is Michael Welch, and you're listening to the Global Research News Hour, a show funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, the Ininu, the Oji-Cree, the Dene, and the Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are available to partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. This week, we provide audio from a special presentation of two Israeli war resistors who were traveling across Canada, shedding light on their bold decision to refuse military service in protest of Israel's occupation of Palestine and its ongoing violence in Gaza. Einat Gerlitz and Tal Mitnick are leading figures in a growing wave of dissent among Israeli youth, challenging the brutal military occupation and advocating for Palestinian liberation. Both of them have paid the price for their stand, enduring time in Israeli military prisons for their refusal to participate in what they call a violent system that perpetuates apartheid and genocide. Their actions have sparked a global conversation about the vital role of war resistors in the fight for human rights and a free Palestine. They are also examples of the call of others in military service during illegal wars to abandon the battlefield, a major activist call by the Center for Research on Globalization. So this week, we thought we would give you the entire presentation by these two heroic individuals at the Hope Mennonite Church in Winnipeg, Manitoba, on March 20th, 2025. The moderator of the event was Harold Schuster, representing the Manitoba chapter of Independent Jewish Voices, who sponsored the tour in collaboration with Mesarvot Network, an Israeli initiative supporting young Israelis refusing military service and thereby elevating their voices in opposition to Israel's occupation and war crimes. Here are Einat and Tal.
Thank you all for the warm welcome in this church and in this land.
Yeah, thanks for everyone that came. It's really incredible to see so many people that come out just to hear us speak. I'd like to start with a little bit of talking about like what's going on right now while we're here on this tour across Canada, talking to people here, what's going on back in Palestine, because in the first couple weeks we were here, we were in the supposed ceasefire, a stopping of bombardments, and in the past couple of days, the bombardments have continued, and in one night, 400 people dead, and since then, hundreds more, and it's hard to start an event without talking about something like this, because it's hard to sleep at night with all the videos and pictures of babies and children and women and men and of all these people who have died in this terrible, terrible genocide. And I wanted to start with that because it felt the most right and that we couldn't go on without that. So I think we were here to tell you about our personal stories and how we came to deciding to refuse, and about the Israeli leftist anti-Zionist movement.
So I'll start with sharing my story. Growing up in the Israeli society, it's a very militarized society. The military is part of everything in our lives. It's very clear that once you finish high school, the next step is military service, and from then on you choose whatever path you want. That the military is everywhere. I have a grandpa that fought in the 67 war, in the 73 war. It affected our family, like many families. We're not special. And just even walking in the street, there's soldiers everywhere with their guns, and on the beach, and it's everywhere. It's part of our lives. And growing up, I grew up in Tel Aviv. But my grandparents live in a kibbutz 5 kilometers from the Gaza border. And growing up, I spent a lot of time at my grandparents, and there's all the time, like there have been attacks on Gaza all the time, and there have been bombs, and in the kibbutz of my grandparents, you have 15 seconds to run to a shelter, and it's a very terrifying experience as a little kid. And I remember that sometimes there would be bombs, like we would hear an explosion, but there wasn't a siren because it was on the other side of the wall. When there's bombardment in northern Gaza, the house is shaking. You feel it. And I remember I asked my grandma, how many seconds do the kids in Gaza have to run to a shelter? And she said that most of them don't have a shelter. And then she continued and said how beautiful the beach in Gaza is, that she thinks it's the most beautiful beach in the world, and that she wishes that we can all visit there someday, and that the Palestinians from there can come visit our beaches, and there won't be these borders and ours and theirs. And growing up, I didn't really resonate with this nationalistic kind of, before they had those words, but this want to hold a gun and run in the field. And I was a very pacifist kid. and growing up, I many kids were, you know, talking about how, like, they admire soldiers or dressing up as soldiers in Purim. And for me, it was clear that I'm just going to do those 2 years, get over with it, and continue on with my life. And growing up, I always felt different from the other girls. And at 15, I had the term for it. I came out of the closet at 15. And coming out and finding community was very big, because those years before coming out, the ones of you who went through, you know, you feel very by yourself. And then finding community of people who went through the same experiences is very, very meaningful. And finding this community in this queer youth group that I joined, I also realized that my trans friends don't go through this, go through some experiences that I don't go through, and that there's differences inside the queer community, and learning about the generations that came before us, and thanks to their struggles, we have the rights that we have today. And I got into going to protests for queer rights, and it really got me into activism. I had this like drive and want to also be part of the struggle, and to continue it forward. And then I joined climate activism, and there not only I found more community, but I understood that my voice can make a change. We were a bunch of high schoolers organizing climate protests, meeting with parliament members on climate laws, and. I think, and it was this big shift. They understood that if I organize with other people that have the same motivations and the same values, we can make change together. Our voice can make a change. And in this climate movement, I met for the first time Palestinian girls. Growing up, we grew up in a very, very separated society. In separated societies, the schools, the cities, the languages. We grow up in very, very separated societies, and it's not a regular thing for an Israeli Jewish girl to have Palestinian friends at 17. And even the fact that they identified as Palestinian, they were Palestinian citizens of Israel. And the fact that they even identified as Palestinian, I was told that they're Israeli Arabs. Even that was a change of what I was told. I was told that the Palestinians are the ones in the West Bank and in Gaza, and the ones in 48 borders are Israeli Arabs. And hearing the word Nakba for the first time at 17, and getting to know that the stories that my grandparents told me are not the stories that their grandparents told them, realizing that I can say whatever I want in a protest, I can hold whatever sign I want, I can post my thoughts on social media, and I can voice my opinions at school. And there are things that they can't afford to voice. There are opinions that they can't afford to voice, and hearing their stories of their families in the West Bank, I had suddenly these faces, these people that I care about behind the word occupation, and understanding that we're all, that it's the same oppressive systems. Like I got to know people that at the time had been already in more, like had more radical ideas than me, and hearing the term climate justice, and this was really big, starting to connect these dots and seeing all these cracks in the narrative that I grew up on, and realizing that there's a whole part of history, and there's a whole people that I never really heard their story, and there are so many things that no one ever told me in school. And I think it was also around the time of the Sheikh Jarrah protests and seeing what's going on there and joining these protests by myself, I understood that there's no way that I'm going to serve the military that oppresses my Palestinian friends. And I decided to refuse. I found Misarvot Network. Misarvot means refusers in the feminine conjugation in Hebrew. Through Misarvot Network, I got to know past refusers and hear their stories and have the social network that I can't stress how important it is to have the social network. And we have legal assistance in Misarvot Network, and I had this assistance throughout appealing to a conscientious committee. A conscientious committee is a committee. It's a committee that can give out conscientious exemptions. The Israeli conscientious committee violates the international standards of conscientious objection. According to international standards, it's supposed to be a committee that's supposed to be a civil committee that can recognize conscientious objectors that are pacifists or not pacifists, ones who oppose their conscientious doesn't let them serve a specific war, a specific military, or any military. In Israel, the conscientious committee is part of the military. So I went there in that room, four generals and one civilian checking my pacifism, because they only recognize this general kind of pacifism that doesn't aspire to affect anyone but me. And they decided that I don't qualify for conscientious exemption. And so my enlistment date came up. Me and three other guys had similar enlistment dates. The four of us refused together with the support of Misarvot Network on September 4th, 2022. We refused. We voiced our objection to the occupation and said that we are not going to serve a military that oppresses one people for the supposed security of the other people. And I sat. When you refuse, you don't know for how long you're going to sit in military prison. You don't know for how long you're going to be sentenced. It could be 2 weeks, and it could be 2 years, like the ones that sat the most in the beginning of the 2000s. And I was sentenced for 87 days in total at a few different imprisonments until I was finally granted another conscientious committee, which gave me an exemption. And through my, I think it's also important to mention that I sat in military prison, but it's not the same military prison that Palestinians are held in. Palestinians face torture, inhuman conditions in the Israeli military prisons. We sat in a military prison that is for soldiers or ones who refuse to be soldiers. So it's a different military prison. That's important to say. And I'll let Tal share his story now.
Thank you. I think first of all, I'd like to recognize how privileged we are to be here. How privileged not only to come here to speak with everyone, but how privileged we are inside our own societies. We both come from Tel Aviv, which is the big city of middle to high class, and we both have supportive families that without them we would not be able to show our face and speak our truth in front of you guys, but also in front of the world with interviews and protests and these kinds of things. And also especially privileged in the fact that we are Israeli Jews in our land, and we live in a land that enacts apartheid and genocide on our Palestinian brothers and sisters, and especially in that way we can speak the way that our brothers and sisters cannot. I grew up in a fairly liberal household. Both my parents are immigrants from the United States, and they both raised me in the values of nonviolence, of talking about the cycle of bloodshed and the cycle of violence that exists in our land, And generally, I was raised in a way that military service was seen as something that I could do, but I also could not do. I was raised in a way that it was my choice. Now, I am in no way saying that my parents are as radical or have the same opinions as me, but being raised in this house where I can say what I believe and I can I can make my own decisions is definitely a step up from what most Israeli society's households have. But no matter how liberally raised or progressively raised you are, the systems of militarism and the systems of brainwashing get to every and every child. Already in first grade, in one of the many attacks on Gaza that we've seen in the past 70 plus years, there was an activity in my school. We were 6 years old. The activity was to write letters to the soldiers that were currently fighting. And I mean, I've talked about this a lot, and I think that the more I say it, the more crazy it sounds, because I see people that are I see kids that are 6 years old, and I think that in the start when I was thinking of it, I didn't realize how insane that actually is to send letters to soldiers that are committing these horrible, horrible acts. And I can't lie. The brainwashing and the militarism that exists in our systems, it can get to you. And it got to me personally too. Especially as a young boy, I think romanticizing, crawling in the mud, holding a weapon, wearing the uniform, and protecting the nation that I come from, protecting the people that are close to me, is something that I remember feeling from a young age, and I know that a lot of young boys and girls do feel. But I'd like to stress that this is the patriarchy acting, and this is the system's idea of manliness telling us how we're supposed to fight for the security of our people. And the systems of patriarchy are telling us that it's only through violence. And later, I realized that what really being a man, what really being a human being is refusing to those systems that taught us that way. In my early teens, I took after my father. He was a journalist. I started learning about the world. I started learning about what's happening around me. And I learned about it in a critical sense. I remember conversations, disagreements, me floating opinions of the right, of the left, and arguing with my parents a lot. But in the end, I took after the critical stance of what we were taught in school and what our systems taught us. And around the age of 15, my father, who was probably the greatest influence on my politicization as a person, fell sick with cancer. And after a long battle with a lot of medication, a lot of doctors, a lot of treatment, and really trying everything we can, he passed away. And this hit our family hard. I'm not here to talk about it, but I'm sure that there are a lot of people in the crowd that can resonate with the pain that it is to lose someone so close to you. He left behind me, my mother, and my two siblings. A couple months after, when we were still in deep grief, I remember, again, taking after him even more and reading about what's happening around me and finding the story of a baby from Gaza named Fatima. She was born, and a couple months later, she was diagnosed with a disease that if she was born here or in Israel, she would have had to go to the doctor, maybe get some treatment, and live on a happy life. But because she's from Gaza, the doctor that she needed to see was in East Jerusalem, and she needed to get a pass from the Israeli security to go to East Jerusalem. After getting delayed and delayed and denied and requesting again and delayed, Fatima passed away at 7 months. And I'm not sure I knew to say it at that moment, but I knew that it brought a great emotion in me. And the feeling of how privileged I am, although having gone through this terrible loss, we have the privilege of knowing that we tried everything, that fate decided that that was what was right. And Fatima's parents and families and close ones do not have the same privilege. They forever, for the rest of their lives, they have to live with the question of what if? What if we were born on the other side of the border? What if we had adequate medical attention? What if we didn't have this murderous siege on our heads? And that was the moment that I decided that not only could I not be the one holding a weapon in the checkpoints, raiding houses in the middle of the night, I cannot be part of any part of this rotten system that is bent on the oppression of Palestinian people. This was around the time of the rise of this new government. And I can't stress this enough. Every government in Israeli history has been fascist, has enacted the occupation, and has oppressed Palestinian people. But this new government is a new kind of evil in the fact that the allies that Netanyahu allied himself with this time, Ben-Gvir and Smotrich and all these evil, evil people, people that until a couple months ago had pictures of mass murderers like Baruch Goldstein up in their kitchen, they started enacting a judicial reform which would take the judiciary into the government's hands, and all the roadblocks and all the walls that the judiciary imposed would be non-existent. And that meant taking away women's rights, that meant taking away LGBTQ plus rights, and the core point of this judicial reform was to annex more and to settle more and to ethnically cleanse the Palestinians out of the West Bank and out of Gaza. And there were mass protests against this, not against specifically the occupation part, but against the judicial reform as a taking a part of the democracy that we have in the state of Israel. And I went out to protest. I went out and I saw a lot of people holding Israeli flags, chanting that they want to go back to what was before Netanyahu, what was before Ben-Gvir, and what was before this horrible judicial reform. But I did not feel comfortable protesting with these people. I found this block of people that recognized that we did not have to go back, but we had to go forward. Yeah. Forward into a future where there's no judicial reform without Netanyahu, without Kahanist allies, but also without an occupation and with justice and freedom for all from the river to the sea. Thanks. Me and a couple other friends, we drafted a refusal letter stating that we will refuse to enlist into an army that occupies another people. We got over 280 signatures, and in a big event of occupying my old school, we showed the letter to the world. We got condemnations from multiple members of Knesset, from the head of the military. That's a badge that I wear with honor. And we really felt that our movement was growing. We really felt that refusal was becoming more mainstream in Israeli society. But as you could have guessed, this all happened in August of 2023, about a month and a half before our whole world would flip on its heads.
So as Tal was preparing his refusal, I was preparing to go to an Arabic course in South Hebron Hills in the Masafir Yatta community. Masafir Yatta, for those of you who aren't familiar with this community, it was shown in the Oscar-winning documentary No Other Land. If you haven't watched it, go watch it. And this community is a community in South Hebron Hills that faces extreme ethnic cleansing and forced displacement and settler violence, military raids, and there is a very beautiful solidarity between the Palestinian activists and Israeli activists and international activists that have been practicing nonviolent co-resistance together in the past almost 3 decades. And I was planning on living there a few months to study Arabic and do protective presence and different solidarity activities. And Tal was preparing his refusal. And then we woke up on October 7th, 6:30 in the morning. I woke up in my parents' house in Tel Aviv to the sound of sirens, of bombs. It was very, very scary. We had no idea what's going on. In the first hours, there was no... The journalists on the media didn't have any information on what's going on. It was very unclear. Obviously, the first phone call was to my grandma, and she and my grandpa were in the shelter, but they were hearing shootings around the kibbutz. It was very stressful. We had no idea what is happening. As the hours went by, we were starting to understand that there has been a massacre and many people were missing. Everyone was looking for their loved ones. My grandparents grieved many of their community members. So it was a very, very, very devastating and very traumatic. It was this massacre. Like, we're still, all of us, still in the trauma from it. And thankfully, my grandparents are okay. And after 3 days, they were able to evacuate the kibbutz. And from the second or third day of after October 7th, we began to see a new reality in the West Bank. If beforehand there was settler violence, there was ethnic cleansing, the occupation was we thought that we were feeling it at one of its rock bottoms. This was a whole new story. The settlers weren't waiting anymore for the military to demolish houses. They began demolishing Palestinian homes by themselves. Settlers were using live ammunition inside of Palestinian villages. This whole new reality was very violent, still is very violent and very terrifying. Many villages couldn't bear the violence anymore and were displaced. And in all of this environment, that there was a rising fascism in our society, and unfortunately, many people, some in our society, and especially the government, took the path of revenge from the October 7th massacre. They took the grief and the trauma into revenge, and that is not our path. And we felt from the beginning that we must voice an opposition. We must speak up. We can't possibly stay silent. From the first few days, it was clear that the massacre is starting to begin in the Gaza Strip, and later on it became a genocide. And we went out to the streets and we began to protest. And even having a sign, "Stop the War," was a very radical thing, and we were arrested for it. And there was insane police violence. And over 100 students, 100 university students, were expelled or expelled from their studies. Some of them arrested for posting on Facebook "Stop the War," for having a Palestinian flag in their Facebook bio, for saying something about the civilians in Gaza. The whole environment was of insane political persecution, especially for the Palestinian Israeli citizens. And this political persecution is still going on today. But in the beginning, it was just insane.
And in this environment, I had my enlistment date coming up.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. My name is Michael Welch. Today, we're hearing a presentation by two Israeli war resistors who refused to serve in the military services of Israel during the Winnipeg stop of their visit of several Canadian cities. Here is more of their presentation.
I want to add a little more about the fact that the same people we were protesting against, the same people we were protesting with against Netanyahu, against the judicial reform, we're now the same people flying the planes over Gaza, murdering children in their sleep. The same politicians that said that they would never sit with Netanyahu, not even speak to him, rallied against him behind the war and the genocide. People were scared, especially Palestinians living inside the state of Israel. Activists were scared, and especially Palestinians living inside the state of Israel. Rising violence in the West Bank, an ongoing genocide, and in this environment, I had my enlistment date coming up. I thought a little bit about it, because it's a scary time to be the voice of opposition. And there was no voice of opposition to this war. Even some of these supposed left-wing organizations could not bring themselves to say, stop the war, could not bring themselves to say, we need to end this right now. And that was my decision. Should I come out publicly and talk about it, or should I do it silently and have no one hear about it? In the end, I decided that, again, I am very privileged in the fact that doing this, I could come home to my family, I will not lose my home, I will still have friends that will call me my friend. And I decided that it's not only something that I should do, it's my duty to come out and to refuse. I refused in the end of December of 2023, talking to a lot of media outlets throughout the world and also some inside Israel. Like Einat said, we were telling people that the message to Israeli society is that revenge will not bring any of the objectives of the war. It will not bring back the hostages. It will not take down Hamas or anything like that. And it will not bring safety to anyone living from the river to the sea. This was a very, very watered down version of what we actually believed because of the environment. But even that, even saying that's just those basic words, I got death threats, and my phone number and my address were leaked. People came up to me in the street. It was a scary time to be the voice of opposition. I ended up sitting 185 days for my refusal to enlist. And after me, there have been 12 public refusers that have come out in opposition to this genocide. The latest one, just yesterday, Ella Kedar Greenberg, the first trans refuser to come out publicly. She was sentenced to 30 days as her first sentence. And I cannot stress how proud and how proud me and Einat are and how to call her our friend. And how brave she is for taking this stance. She did not know if she was going to be sent to solitary confinement or to a men's prison or to a women's prison. She did not know what was going to come. And this is not just the two of us that are coming here to talk to you. There's a movement of people behind us. Although small, but we try to be strong. And we've built real community. And we hold each other up when times are tough. And we always come out in opposition to the genocide, and we will always come out in opposition to the oppression of the Palestinian people. Thank you.
I just want to add about Ella that she is held in the women's department, but they are currently not letting her medicine inside and basically denying her right now from hormone replacement therapy. Thankfully in Misalvot we have the legal assistance to help her in this, and we're hoping that the situation won't go on very long and they will respect the hormones that she needs to take. And on this note, in Misalvot Network, we support refusers throughout whatever challenges arise. And the only act that we control is the refusal. The rest is that there's a big uncertainty factor going through the imprisonments in the military prison. And I would like to ask you guys to continue and share on the refusal stories and the Israelis who are objecting the genocide. You can follow Misalvot Network. There's like these barcodes on the flyers in the entrance. I ask you if you can follow us on social media. There's also, there's also a link there that you can write a solidarity to Ella, which from our experience, getting letters in prison from people supporting from the outside is the most strengthening thing you can have. And also, if anyone feels like they can and want to donate and support our legal assistance system, that would be much appreciated. And I think it's very important for us to have enough time for questions and to hear what you guys have to ask. Thank you.
And free Palestine.
No need to apologize. So I'm sure some of you might have some questions. We'll have people going around with cue cards and pens. We would ask you to clearly write out your question, and we will gather those and give them to our moderator, the always amazing Joanna Hebert-Bergen from the Mennonite Church Manitoba Palestine Israel Network. Joanna, where are you? Oh, there you are. Okay. So while we're handing out the cue cards, if you have a question, again, please write it out clearly. We'll gather them, and while we're doing that, I think Joanne has a couple of questions to get us started.
There is an amazing community. Tal and Enat, you talked about community and the importance of it. There's an amazing community in Manitoba of folks who really believe that the cause of Palestinian human rights, the importance of international law and human rights law, and the need for a free Palestine means that we are brothers and sisters to each other, and we band together. And I'm grateful for people like Harold and so many of you in this room, because I think that this is something that no one of us could do alone, the work for a free Palestine. It calls us to be community for each other. And any one of you who are not yet engaged are certainly welcome to join. I'm going to just say two sentences. I want to acknowledge and dedicate the Q&A today to Somaya, who was born on Sunday, to my friend Amjad and his wife Kumar. They are currently in Gaza City. Somaya has two brothers, Majd, who's 5, and Ibrahim, who's 3. And I think about them all the time. So I want to thank Tal and Enat for your openness to coming to Canada, to sharing your story, to being courageous, to risk. I know you say the risks, I understand the risks are different for Palestinians than for Israeli Jews, but I think there is a significant amount of risk in what you did and what you are doing. And what your story does for us is sort of fuels our courage. And I'm so grateful to have you here tonight with us. I'm going to start with a question. So here we are in Winnipeg, and I'm wondering, as Canadians, what we can do to ensure a free Palestine.
Thank you for the question. I'd like to say that we are part of the struggle from within, and we need you guys to do the struggle from without. Everyone that's sitting here in the room has also responsibility in the struggle. And while we are struggling from within, change will only come when we struggle both from within and from without. And we need you guys, especially with the elections coming up, to pressure your governments, pressure the Canadian government, pressure the provinces to stop investing in Israel, stop selling arms to Israel. An arms embargo is crucial to stop the genocide, and there are many, many things that you can do. You have beautiful, we got to know that you have beautiful Palestinian initiatives here in Winnipeg that I'm sure that you are happy that people will join them and going to the weekly rallies and really voicing this pressure on the Canadian government to stop being complicit to this genocide is crucial, and we need you guys.
So you talked a bit about the importance of community, and I'm just wondering if you can say a bit more about how, when things are emotional and frightening, how do you support each other?
When we do stuff that is emotionally draining, like, for example, going to a protest, maybe going to protective presence, or going to a family dinner with the one or the whole racist family, we find community in each other in our friendships, but we also find community in the greater activist circle. We have community in Tel Aviv, in Haifa, in Jerusalem, of really amazing people with open arms that accept anybody into it. And that's what's special about our movement. That's what's special about the left, that it accepts everyone. So if it means staying up till 4 in the morning outside the jail to wait for a release of an arrestee, or if it means coming out to protest outside the prison where refuseniks like me and Einat have sat, the community is so important, and knowing that you have the back of people that are right now activists, people that are in the past, is very, very important in keeping the struggle going.
Okay, so somebody wants to know if there's a way to hear about your full story. Have you written any articles, or is there a way to help us understand you better?
First of all, I'm surprised that you want to hear more from us. There are articles that we interviewed to. A lot of them have the same stories that we told here, and the same like evolution of our ideas. I haven't written a book yet, but there's a profile in The Guardian, and there are a bunch of like interviews on YouTube where it's a more insightful like on the day-to-day life, and also there many other refusers that have incredible stories and probably more interesting than mine. For example, just a week ago, Itamar Greenberg got an exemption after 195 days in military prison. He comes from an ultra-Orthodox family, and his relationship with his family and the struggle with refusing and going against the grain in two ways in his society, also being leaving the religion but also not enlisting, is a really interesting story, and if you want, you can also look it up. The Guardian just had a 12-minute piece about him. So there are a lot of other stories to hear. Yeah.
And you can all find it if you scan the link, and then you can get to our social media, and that's where all the stories are. I think we're just going to stay there. Yeah. If there's one asking questions.
Another question for you is, and this is a long one, but I'm just going to sort of try and sum it up and say, can you say something about a one-state or a two-state solution?
The opposition to Jewish supremacy inside Israeli Jewish society is so, so small. There are people, and the solution to this 70-plus, 80-plus year problem is it seems so far. And Mesarvot as a network, our network that we come from, does not have an official position on a lot of political topics. We have our own positions, and I can share that my opinion is that the most important aspect of finding a solution is having Palestinians at the negotiating table. Not between Israel and Qatar, not between Israel and Europe or the United States or Egypt. To have Palestinians at the negotiating table and to hear what the Palestinians really want, which I've heard many times that it's freedom and justice, is the most important aspect of finding the solution.
There's so much disinformation and propaganda about what's happening. Any advice on how to know what's true?
It's an important question. It's important to look at everything, all the information that we consume with critical thinking, obviously. I can recommend 972 magazine and B'Tselem, an Israeli organization for human rights, as great information sources to follow what's going on. There are many bigger media, mainstream media like Al Jazeera that also is a good source of information. But I feel like the most reliable source you can find is B'Tselem.
But also every source of news has to be critiqued because there's no perfect sense of news and you can't go to one and have the perfect set of facts and opinions, and every source of news has opinions in it, so we really need to critique every source that we consume.
Okay, you're talking about critique, so are there certain questions or frameworks that you use when you come upon an article or hear a podcast?
Well, first of all, we have to see who wrote it. and from what background they come from, maybe what biases they have, and how they're framing what's happening, and think about the words that they use, if it's militants or terrorists or armed men, or freedom fighters. These are all words that if you go on different news places, you'll find different words being used. And we shouldn't take the word, when someone says terrorist, we should know that they're using it in a racially motivated way and think about how it came to be that this source of media that reports on the incident of maybe Palestinian militants defending their city in Jenin, but they call them terrorists. So that's I don't know, I'm not a big news guy, but.
Are there any reports of desertions from the IDF? And if so, how many soldiers are deserting, do you know?
There is no public information on this. The military doesn't give out the numbers of the deserters or the conscientious objectors or ones who appeal for a conscientious exemption. We don't have those numbers. The only number I can give you is the public refusers, who are, again, the ones who have, refusal isn't a privilege, but refusing publicly definitely is. So we have only the numbers of the public refusers. The military doesn't share those numbers, and we sat with many, many deserters in the military prison.
Do you think there is any reason to think there is hope for change in Israel's path towards the genocide of Palestinians?
I think it changes. There are times where I feel hope. There are times where I don't feel hope. And I'm going to be completely honest. It's dwindling down with Trump being elected, with the blowing up of the ceasefire, obviously by Israel, it's starting to seem very, very dark, the future. And at the same time, we have to believe that there is a future. And we know that it's not practical and impossible to eliminate a whole people. And there's so much suffering happening right now. It's hard to say that there's it feels so privileged and so up in the like head in the clouds to say that there will be a solution. So it's hard for me to say how will this thing end, and it makes me sad to say that even about my own society, that it is a society that is committing a genocide.
I would like to share that I think we should find the hope in the small things. Sorry to be optimistic. I think that with all the pain and the grief and the terrible suffering that is happening around us, we need to find and create those small places of hope, because from there I think the change will come. The co-resistance in Masafiriata, from the amazing people that we're meeting here throughout Canada, who are creating a meeting IJV, which are creating an amazing alternative to what Jewish values can be and should be throughout this country. There are many places of hope. And I think that we need to create them, and we need to strengthen them. And it could be, and again, there's so many ways to create this hope. Just a few weeks ago in Hamilton, we met this amazing Palestinian activist that organized to bring more than 1,000 tents inside of Gaza. She did a huge fundraiser and brought in those tents. There are small places of hope. We need to look for them, and we need to create them, and we need to make them bigger, because that's all we have.
How much time, Harold? Two more questions? Okay. I think I just want to add to that some of the spaces where we can find hope in Manitoba are through the Palestinian community here. Canadian, like CPAM, Canadian Palestinian Association of Manitoba, those folks are incredibly resilient and creative and welcoming. Welcoming, if you've been to any iftars lately, you'll meet Palestinians. And they have family members that they've lost in Gaza and in the West Bank and continue to lose. So again, in terms of this community that we have in this amazing province, the Palestinian community is exceptional in terms of their ability to welcome anyone who's curious and who wants to be a part of working for justice. All right. Any interesting conversations in prison with guards or inmates that changed hearts and minds?
You guys want to hear a really corny one? Or the less? I was in a tents division with a guy from the military police. And the military police, I don't know if you guys know this, or the like, the people that enlist there are the people that enlist to want to beat up Palestinians. That's what they enlist to. And I was talking to this guy from Jerusalem, very, very right wing. And this whole time we weren't really talking about politics, but the last night that I was there before getting released, he tells me, "Tal, I wanted to tell you this for a long time." And he tells me how he grew up hating. He grew up hating Palestinians. He grew up hating leftists. And when he first enlisted to the military, the first night he was made to sleep with a Druze guy and with a Bedouin guy in the same room. And he told his commander that he will not sleep with them. He just cannot sleep with people that are not Jewish and especially people that are Arab. But he formed a very deep connection with these people. And he tells me, "Tal, I go and I am a police at these protests that I know that you and your friends go to. And if before I hated so much the protesters, now I know that just like I have a mother that loves me, that you have a mother that loves you." And I mean, right now saying it and knowing that this was a soldier that has probably beat up multiple hundreds, if not more, Palestinians, Jewish resistors, it's in bad taste. But But it really shows how exposure to other people can at least break through, at least crack this deep, deep hatred that exists in so many people. And yeah, I don't think I changed anyone's mind. I know that I didn't change anyone's mind, but I know that some people will go back to their homes and talk with their friends about leftists, about Palestinians, and everyone will say that they hate all the leftists, and some of them, my friends, might say, oh, yeah, I hate all the... Whoa, sorry, I'm really sorry. Yeah, I hate all these leftists, but there is this one guy in prison that is pretty cool. So that's the crack in the... Yeah.
All right, before I hand the mic back to Harold, my next question to you is, are there any questions you wished we would have asked you tonight that you would like to answer?
What a question, wow. I think that maybe something that that I want all of us to go out from this evening today is there's people greater and smarter than me that have said that none of us are free until everyone is free. And I think this should be our guidance. And as a queer woman, the way that I got to refuse was by intersectionality and connecting struggles, and realizing that the systems that oppress my community are the systems that oppress the Palestinian community and that oppress many other oppressed groups in our society. And I think that's something that, like, talking about that intersectionality and creating those connections, because we're the biggest threat to the system when we make those connections and when we connect our struggles and when we work together. And the status quo, and things will continue and go to a more and more fascist direction if we let them divide and conquer us. And that's what I want us to think about when we leave this room today.
This week, we aired the entire presentation of two Israeli war resistors during their multiple city tour of Canada to talk about why they refused to militarily serve Israel during its occupation of Palestine and its siege of Gaza, and how people outside of Israel could help. It took place at Hope Mennonite Church in downtown Winnipeg on the evening of March 20th and was filled to capacity. People who have been listening in Winnipeg might also be interested in attending an event this evening, March 28th. The West End Cultural Center of Winnipeg is hosting an evening in support of Gaza's children, featuring Winnipeg musicians Molly Grubb and Old Man Hat, and headlined by the band Op Ed. This evening event is committed to using music for justice, empathy, and change. All proceeds will go directly to the Palestinian Children's Relief Fund to provide critical aid to the children of Gaza. Global Research News Hour is a show funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. On the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, the Innu, the Ojibwe, the Dene, and the Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation, the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. If you have feedback on this or any show, send it to globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. Music was Shifting Sands by Purple Planet Music, available at purple-planet.com. My name is Michael Welch. Come back next week. Thanks for listening.